the headlines. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says that it is becoming increasingly difficult to extend an agreement with Iran on the inspection of the country's nuclear sites. China lodges a complaint with the U.S. following a visit by a bipartisan delegation of U.S. senators to Taiwan. And India begins a gradual easing of restrictions in major cities amid a downward trend in coronavirus cases in the country. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says that it is becoming increasingly difficult to extend an agreement with Iran on inspection of the country's nuclear sites.
I certainly hope that, be it ideally through the agreement, the wider general agreement that it's been worked on downtown, or by some other means, we are not going to see our activities, our inspection capacities curtailed anymore, because of everything I've said in my reports and today with you. Because this matters, because what's going on is serious. We have to be aware of this, and we cannot limit and continue to curtail the ability of the inspectors to inspect and at the same time pretend that there is trust.
During his press conference in Vienna, Rafael Mariano Grossi said the agency will do whatever it deems appropriate to make Iran give the explanations that they ask for. Tehran's decision to limit the monitoring followed the Iranian parliament's legislation in December that asked the government to scale back nuclear-related commitments. The measure came in response to the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal and its anti-Iran sanctions. Homolesky says if Vienna talks fail to revive Iran's nuclear deal and remove all anti-Iran sanctions, Iran will dramatically restrict the International Atomic Energy Agency's access to its nuclear sites.
If there is success in the Vienna talks to revive the nuclear deal and there is a new JCPOA in place, then Iran will go back to its commitments and the sanctions will be lifted. Then at that time, Iran will give that information to the agency. If that's not the case, Iran has said it is going to delete that information. So it is of vital importance now that if the JCPOA talks do fail, this would mean that the agency will lose access to that information, and the level of access that it will have to Iran from that stage onwards would be dramatically reduced. It has already been reduced, as we know, because based on a law that was passed by Parliament in Iran, the decision was made to restrict IAEA access. A lot of the access that Iran was giving to the agency, of course, went over and beyond its comprehensive safeguards agreement with the IAEA and its NPT obligations. All of these transparency and voluntary measures that Iran was implementing, Iran was doing so under the JCPOA, and it decided to stop those transparency measures until the U.S. sanctions are removed. And doesn't look up until now, at least we're not getting any signs that that's going to happen. That's why he was saying that, you know, if this doesn't happen by the 24th of June, there's not an awful amount of time left now.
China has lodged a complaint with the United States following a visit by three U.S. senators to Taiwan. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says it has expressed dissatisfaction with making solemn representations to Washington. The statement came after a bipartisan delegation of three U.S. senators arrived in Taiwan on Sunday as part of a larger visit to the Indo-Pacific region. American and Taiwanese officials say the trip has been aimed at distributing COVID-19 vaccines. That is while Taiwan accuses China of causing trouble for the self-ruled island for receiving pandemic-related international aid. Taiwan continues to remain a sensitive territorial issue for China and a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington. Russia formally withdraws from the Open Skies Arms Control Pact after Washington's refusal to rejoin the pact that it left last year. President Vladimir Putin has signed the withdrawal legislation after getting approval from the parliament last week. The Kremlin says the U.S. decision to withdraw from the treaty has significantly upset the balance of interest among the pact's members, compelling Russia to exit. The former U.S. President Donald Trump left the treaty in November, accusing Russia of violating it. The succeeding administration of President Joe Biden refused to re-enter the accord on Monday, citing the same accusations. Russia has repeatedly denied the allegations, calling the U.S. decision a political mistake. Authorities in India's capital, New Delhi, and financial hub, Mumbai, have begun a gradual easing of restrictions amid a downward trend in coronavirus infections in the country. India witnessed a record surge last month, overwhelming hospitals in major cities. The government managed to flatten the curve with regional restrictions. Total infections now stand closer to 29 million, with more than 100,000 new cases over the past 24 hours. The death toll is also nearing 350,000, with over 2,400 new fatalities. Elsewhere in Asia, Taiwan has been dealing with a spike in infections, prompting authorities to extend restrictions for another 2 weeks. Neighboring Thailand has kicked off a long-awaited mass vaccination campaign amid a third wave of the epidemic. Australia's Victoria State has reported the biggest rise in new cases despite a hard lockdown there. Campaigning is gaining momentum in Iran for the June 18th presidential election. People have taken to social media to react to the first televised debate between the seven candidates. Hashtag Trending takes a look at some of the viral tweets.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Iran's upcoming presidential election and campaigning to win the majority of the votes has been among the most observed topics across social media. Let's see what's trending about the Iranian election. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on the nation to participate in the presidential polls with a high turnout. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has urged the people to help resolve the country's issues and shortcomings by making the right decision at the ballot box. Social media users have echoed the leader's remarks about participating in the polls. They say they want to have a role to play in deciding the fate of the country by heading to the ballots and casting their votes. Let's start with the first tweet of the day by Amir Reza. He said, "The leader's order is the most important thing for us, and the leader says that it is our duty to vote, so we do not leave our leader alone. We love our country." Yes, we do. Hidden wrote, "Not voting is a choice in itself. It means letting others decide for you and for your country instead of you. Do not be deceived and do not make the enemies happy." That's why Election Day is commonly referred to as Decision Day. Our next comment comes from A. Hassanzadeh, who wrote, "Participation in elections is the sign that we are still standing." Okay, the seven candidates for the June 18th election held the first of the three planned televised debates that was mainly focused on the issue of economics. Now let's review some of the people's reactions to the performance of the candidates during the debate. All right, we'll start with the first one by Ashraf, who said, "Very interesting so far. Mr. Raisi seems amazing. No wonder Zionists try to character assassinate him. His honesty, care for workers, standing against privatization, interactions and involvement with the ordinary, we the people, place him in number one winner in the first debate so far." He also said, "Number two so far seems Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh. His calm and no-nonsense and right-to-the-point answers place him in the number two seat. Saeed Jalili, as always, seems to possess a gifted analytical mind. However, his answers were not as precise, but comes across as extremely knowledgeable." On to the next comment by Ramesh, who wrote, "Economy was the predominant theme of the first of three Iranian presidential debates. Raisi unveils housing plan, 4 million housing units to be built in 4 years. On to the next comment, which has a picture in it, by Iman Gorji. He said, "The action of the great devil USA for the Iranian election." Now, despite all the ups and downs and the problems that the country is facing right now, many Iranians have tweeted about the importance of participating in the polls as a means of people's sovereignty in a democratic political system. We got our final batch of tweets with the first one by Tayyebe, who wrote, "Elections are very important, and the people must choose the right person and the true servants of the country and society." On to the next one by Yasna, who said, "Elections are one of the symbols of people's sovereignty in a political system." True, election is probably the main pillar in any democratic political system. The next one comes from Amira Arsalan, who said, "Although your sanctions have no effect, oh, our fingerprints have an effect. And yes, and every single vote counts." Our final comment of the day comes from Amir Abbas, who said, "Important advice of Martyr Soleimani about choosing a responsible person. Brothers, sisters, become a righteous society ruled by righteous people. In the presence of our diligence and awareness, we choose the right individual." Okay, that's going to be it for me and this edition of Hashtag Trending. It's time to get back to the studio now. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Israeli organizers of a pro-settler rally have canceled their planned march that was due to be held in occupied East Jerusalem outlets this Thursday. The organizers said the parade was scrapped amid a dispute with Israeli forces over its route. Earlier, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned that holding the rally could trigger new conflict, like last month's fighting. Israel and the Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza fought an 11-day war in May. Resistance groups dealt severe blows to Israel by firing some 4,300 rockets in response to the regime's aggression. Israeli media say the massive rocket fire pushed Tel Aviv to ask the U.S. to mediate a ceasefire. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas thanks Yemen's Ansarullah movement and the people of Yemen for their support for the Palestinian cause. Hamas representative in Yemen, Maaz Abu Shamala, conveyed the movement's message of gratitude during a meeting with senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi. During the talks, Houthi congratulated Palestinians on their victory against the Israeli regime during the 11-day war on Gaza. He pledged Nasrallah's support for the Palestinian cause and the liberation of Palestine, which he described as keys to protecting the Islamic Ummah and his honor. He added that Yemenis consider it essential and an honor to stand by Palestinians. The West has condemned Belarus for diverting a passenger plane's flight path traveling between two EU capitals and arresting a dissident on board. Belarus, who denied the accusations, said the airliner was ordered to land over a security threat. But is the West trying to make a case against Belarus and its main ally, Russia?
Tensions are growing between the West and Belarus after Minsk scrambled a fighter jet to divert the flight path of a Lithuania-bound Ryanair passenger plane and forced it to land late last month. Minutes after the landing, Belarusian authorities arrested 26-year-old opposition blogger Roman Protasevich and his fiancée who were on the plane. The move infuriated the European Union and the United States.
And Belarus used its control over its airspace in order to perpetrate a state hijacking. Therefore, the safety and security of flights through Belarus airspace can no longer be trusted.
During a summit in Brussels, EU leaders urged carriers based on the bloc to avoid flying over Belarus. In addition, they have agreed to ban Belarusian airlines from using the bloc's airspace and airports. The 27-nation bloc has slammed more economic sanctions on Belarus. The EU says it has indefinitely frozen a 3 billion euro investment package for the country. Minsk's move has been slammed by some EU leaders as, quote, state piracy.
Essentially, Belarus is very highly aligned to Russia, and that is the choice that they made. Well, this doesn't sit well with U.S. imperialist efforts who want to see all, essentially all countries in the world allied to them and subservient to them. Now, this is part of a larger U.S. strategy to try to encircle Russia within Europe. As we know that the current Ukrainian crisis is going on right now, where NATO-aligned forces are going to be fighting Russian-aligned and full-on Russian forces probably sometime in mid-June when the permafrost finally melts and it's more advantageous to move large vehicles across Ukraine. Belarus is allied to Russia.
Belarus says it requested the emergency landing due to a suspected bomb threat on the plane. The airliner then left Minsk for its destination in Lithuania shortly after.
Well, EU leaders have called for the immediate release of the Belarusian opposition figure. This is while the blogger appeared on the country's state TV. He said that he was confessing to charges brought against him. Well, in the meantime, Russia has warned the West, that's the most recent development, against interfering in Belarus's internal affairs. So the question comes about, is the West seeking another excuse to prosecute Belarus and its ally Russia?
In a video broadcast by Belarusian state media, Roman Protasevich said he was in good health and cooperating with the country's officials.
Hello, my name is Roman Protasevich. I was detained yesterday at the Minsk National Airport. I'm now in the Minsk Detention Center number 1. I can say that I don't have any health issues, including heart or any other organs disease. Police officers treat me properly and according to the law. Also, I now continue to cooperate with the investigation and give a confession on organizing mass protests in Minsk.
The opposition was quick to reject the statement, arguing that Protasevich was confessing under duress. But Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has denied any wrongdoing, accusing the West of seeking to provoke unrest in his country. In a meeting with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, Lukashenko said the West is trying to, quote, rock the boat to cause a new round of protests against his government. He was referring to the outbreak of protests after the 2020 presidential election, when his opponent and Western countries accused his government of voter fraud. President Putin has also warned the West against meddling in Belarus's internal affairs. He also dismissed speculations that Russia participated in diverting the airliner.
This isn't simply someone being targeted by a country for, you know, whatever reason. There is a very clear process here. Person is wanted for a crime, and if they pass through the country, then they are going to be stopped. I mean, this is not even comparable to, say, Chinese Huawei CFO who was stopped in Canada for a crime that doesn't even exist there.
The recent incident wasn't the first that led to rising tensions between the West and Belarus, which is in a union state with Russia, and will certainly not be the last.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. An American contractor went to a small town in the Guatemalan mountains with an ambitious goal: to ignite the local economy and hopefully even persuade local people not to migrate north to the United States. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Natalie Kitroff and Michael Shear. The piece is titled, USA to Central America Hasn't Slowed Migration. Can Kamala Harris? An American contractor went to a small town in the Guatemalan mountains with an ambitious goal: to ignite the local economy and hopefully even to persuade local people not to migrate northwards to the United States. Half an hour into his meeting with coffee growers in Guatemala, the contractor excitedly revealed the tool he had brought to change their lives. a pamphlet inviting the farmers to download an app to check coffee prices and be part of modern agriculture. Pedro Aguilar, a coffee farmer who hadn't asked for the training and didn't see how it would keep anyone from heading to the border, looked confused. Eyeing the US government logo on the pamphlet, he began waving it around, asking if anyone had a phone number to call the Americans and tell them what our needs really are. "They've never helped me," Pedro Aguilar said after a training a few weeks ago, referring to American aid programs intended to spur the economy and prevent migration. "Where does all the money go? Where's the aid? Who knows?" As Vice President, Joseph R. Biden Jr. led an enormous push to deter people from crossing into the United States by devoting hundreds of millions of dollars to Central America, hoping to make the region more tolerable for the poor so that fewer poor people would abandon it. Now, as President Biden, he's doubling down on that strategy once again and assigning his own Vice President, Kamala Harris, the prickly challenge of carrying out his plan to commit $4 billion in a remarkably similar approach as she traveled to the region on Sunday, 6th of June. "When I was Vice President, I focused on providing the help needed to address these root causes of migration," Joe Biden said in a recent speech to Congress. "It helped keep people in their own countries instead of being forced to leave. Our plan worked." But the numbers tell a very different story. After years of the United States flooding Central America with aid, migration from the region soared in 2019 and is on the upswing once again. Here in Guatemala, which has received more than $1.6 billion in American aid over the last 10 years, poverty rates have risen. Malnutrition has become a national crisis. Corruption is unbridled. And the country is sending more unaccompanied children to the United States than anywhere else in the world. That is the stark reality facing Vice President Kamala Harris as she assumes responsibility for expanding the same kind of aid programs that have struggled to stem migration in the past. It is a challenge that initially frustrated her top political aides, some of whom viewed the assignment from Joe Biden as one that would inevitably set her up for failure in the first months of her tenure. Her allies worried that she would be expected to solve the entire immigration crisis, irked that the early reports of her new duties appeared to hold her responsible for juggling the recent surge of children crossing the border without adults. Kamala Harris, who has little foreign policy experience and no history in the region, has already been criticized for not visiting the border. At a recent news conference, a group of Republicans displayed a milk carton that has been mocked up to show a picture of Kamala Harris with the headline, "Missing at the Border," even as she held a news conference with reporters detailing her plans to visit the region. The political risks are evident, including the obvious pitfalls of investing billions of dollars in a region where the president of Honduras has been linked to drug traffickers and accused of embezzling American aid money. The leader of El Salvador has been denounced for trampling democratic norms. And the government of Guatemala has been criticized for persecuting officials who are fighting corruption. Even so, Kamala Harris and her advisors have warmed to the task, according to several people familiar with her thinking in the White House. They say it will give her a chance to dive squarely into foreign policy and prove that she can pass the commander-in-chief test, negotiating with world leaders on a global stage to confront one of America's most intractable issues. That test began on Sunday, 6th of June, when Kamala Harris embarked on her first international trip to Guatemala and onward to Mexico, where she's expected to detail efforts to reduce migration to the United States by seeking to improve conditions in those countries. Injustice is a root cause of migration, Kamala Harris said during a White House meeting on 19th of May, with four women who fought corruption in Guatemala. It is causing the people of the region to leave their homes involuntarily, meaning they don't want to leave, but they're fleeing. While White House officials say their push to help Central America can do a tremendous amount of good, there is growing recognition inside the Biden administration that all the money spent in the region has not made enough of a difference to keep people from migrating, according to several administration officials and others with knowledge of the discussions. We've looked extensively at different programs that have been approached, said Nancy McElderny, a longtime diplomat who serves as Kamala Harris's national security advisor. She obviously has learned a lot from then Vice President Joe Biden did, and so we're very mindful of the need to learn of both positive and negative what has happened in the past. Foreign aid is often a difficult and at times flawed tool for achieving American interests abroad, but it's unclear whether there are any simple alternatives for the Biden administration. Former President Donald Trump's solution to migration centered on draconian policies that critics denounced as unlawful and inhumane. Moreover, members of the current administration contend that Donald Trump's decision to freeze a proportion of the aid to the region in 2019 ended up blunting the impact of the work being done to improve conditions there. But experts say the reasons that years of aid have not curbed migration run far deeper than that. In particular, they note that much of the money is handed over to American companies, which swallow up a lot of it for salaries, expenses, and profits, often before any services are delivered to local people. From 2016 to 2020, 80% of the American financed development projects in Central America were entrusted to American contractors, according to data provided by the U.S. Agency for International Development. The upside is that these companies have big offices capable of meeting the strict oversight requirements involved in handling millions of taxpayer dollars. The downside, critics say, is that a lot of money disappears into those bureaucracies instead of reaching the people they're trying to help. Half a dozen development experts who have worked with or for the contractors said the companies could easily take about 50% of the aid money they receive and direct it towards overheads, including generous salaries for their executives and company profits. When asked about that figure, USAID did not contest it. It's a business, said Carlos Pons, a professor of nonprofit management at Columbia University, who has worked for several U.S.-funded programs in the region. And the same implementers win their contracts again and again, despite having implemented badly in the past, not showing any level of impact and not changing anything. USAID would not provide an estimate of how much taxpayer money spent on specific projects in Central America gets eaten up by administrative costs, noting that the agency is legally restricted from sharing its partners' proprietary information. It's an incredibly not transparent situation, said Eric Olson, an expert on foreign aid to Central America at the Seattle International Foundation. Eric Olson added, "It's like this is a national secret." Kamala Harris's aides say she wants to make absolutely sure that as much assistance as possible heads directly to the communities it is intended for. She's concerned to make sure that we're getting maximum benefit for every single dollar that we spend, Ms. McElderny said. Asked whether that included scrutinizing the money flowing to U.S. contractors, she said, "We're looking at that issue." Even when aid money reached Guatemala in recent years, it often brought little change, according to interviews with dozens of people who worked with or received assistance from U.S. finance projects in the country's Western Highlands. One, called the Rural Value Chains Project, spent part of its $20 million in American aid building outhouses for potato farmers, many of which were quickly abandoned or torn apart for scrap metal. This brings no value to the people, said Arturo Cabrera, a local government official, peeking into an unused outhouse. It doesn't generate income, which is what people ultimately need, he added.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر.
Imam Khomeini's viewpoints on the issue of Palestine. The Zionists are not people of religion. The false claims of being followers of Hazrat Moses, peace be upon him. There is one point I should make, and that is out of these well-known religions, which are today universally recognized by mankind, those being the religions of Hazrat Moses, Jesus, and Islam, when we examine the life of the Prophet Hazrat Moses, upon whom be peace, how he lived, the nature of his message and the struggle he embarked upon with the Taghut, with the oppressors, and compare this with how his people, how those who say we are the people of Hazrat Moses, we are the followers of Hazrat Moses act, we see there is no comparison. Moses opposed the Taghut, and these people who say they are the followers of Hazrat Moses are themselves Taghuts, yet they claim to be his followers.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another episode of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. And I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. Imam Khomeini has said in one of his speeches that if the nations would become aware of Islam, they will realize that whatever they seek exists in Islam. Now, generally, we know that the movements which are in the world, the freedom movements or any kind of movements, revolutions that were in the world, they all were for the reform of the mankind. The people were either slaves or they were like there was a racism. For example, we had this black movement or the things before it in the America as well, the Red Indians, the way they were killed by those who migrated to that place and who took their place, occupation, occupying someone's land. That we have obviously the Palestinians in this time and the time before, we have other examples. So I don't need to just bring the names or examples. I don't need to bring these names and examples. Just mentioning a couple of examples so our minds comes closer to the idea which Imam Khomeini is talking about. He says that anything that the nation seeks, it exists in Islam. Now we were trying to think, what does nation seek? They seek reform, they seek freedom, they want justice in the society. Obviously, when we have a parliament, when we have some people who are managing a country, they should distribute the resources justly among the people. So this justice is also something which nations are seeking.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Investigative Europe revealed that the EU, the UK, and Switzerland could be forced to pay more than 345 billion euros in ECT lawsuits over climate action in the coming years. This amount, which is more than twice the EU's annual budget, represents the total value of the fossil fuel infrastructure that is protected by ECT and was calculated using data gathered by Global Energy Monitor and Change of Oil International. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Fabian Flu, Cecilia Olivet, and Pia Eberhardt, researchers. This article is published under the heading, "This Obscure Energy Treaty is the Greatest Threat to the Planet You've Never Heard Of." Stay tuned for the details, please. On February 4th, the German energy giant RWE announced it was suing the government of the Netherlands. The crime? Proposing to phase out coal from the country's electricity mix. The company, which is Europe's biggest emitter of carbon, is demanding 1.4 billion euros in compensation from the country for loss of potential earnings because the Dutch government has banned the burning of coal for electricity from 2030. If this sounds unreasonable, then you might be surprised to learn that this kind of legal action is perfectly normal and likely to become far more commonplace in the coming years. RWE is suing under the Energy Charter Treaty ECT, a little-known international agreement signed without much public debate in 1994. The treaty binds more than 50 countries and allows foreign investors in the energy sector to sue governments for decisions that might negatively impact their profits, including climate policies. Governments can be forced to pay huge sums in compensation if they lose an ECT case. Recently, Investigative Europe revealed that the EU, the UK, and Switzerland could be forced to pay more than 345 billion euros in ECT lawsuits over climate action in the coming years. This amount, which is more than twice the EU's annual budget, represents the total value of the fossil fuel infrastructure that is protected by the ECT and was calculated using data gathered by Global Energy Monitor and Change of Oil International. With ECT-covered assets worth 141 billion euros or more than 2,000 euros per citizen, the UK, which in 2019 became the first major economy to pass a net zero emissions law, is the country most vulnerable to future claims. In 2019, the European Commission called the ECT outdated and no longer sustainable, and more than 450 climate leaders and scientists and 300 lawmakers from across Europe have called on governments to withdraw from the treaty. But in response, powerful interests have mobilized to not just defend the treaty, but to expand it to new signatory states. These interests include the fossil fuels lobby, keen to keep its outsized legal privileges, lawyers who make millions arguing ECT cases, and the Brussels-based ECT Secretariat, which has close ties to both industries and whose survival depends on the treaty's continuation. Supporters of the ECT make a number of controversial claims to prevent countries from leaving the treaty and persuade new countries to join, but their myths and misinformation are easily debunked. For example, ECT supporters say the treaty attracts foreign investment, including into clean energy. However, there is no clear evidence that ECT-style agreements do this. A recent meta-analysis of 74 studies found that investment agreements' effect on increasing foreign investment is so small as to be considered zero. And while ECT supporters claim the treaty protects renewable investments, in reality it predominantly protects and prolongs the fossil fuel-dominated status quo. In recent years, only 20% of investments protected by ECT covered clean energy, compared to 56% for coal, oil, and gas. By protecting the status quo, the ECT acts as a bodyguard for polluters. As RWE example shows, when a government decides to phase out coal or cease oil and gas operations, fossil fuel companies can demand steep compensation via ECT. So with no public benefits and clear risk for climate action, why are countries hesitant to leave the treaty? Two more myths are preventing them from taking action. Firstly, ECT proponents claim that an ongoing process to modernize the treaty will fix its flaws. But modernization has proceeded at a snail's pace since 2017 and is unlikely to succeed given resistance from powerful ECT members like Japan, whose companies have used the ECT to take legal action against other governments. Leaked reports show that the talks are stalled due to their requirement to take decisions unanimously. No signatory state has proposed removing its dangerous corporate courts, which take the form of arbitration tribunals run by three private lawyers. No state has proposed a clear exemption for climate action. No ECT member wants to exclude protection of fossil fuel from the modernized treaty anytime soon. In short, the negotiations around ECT modernization will not bring the treaty in line with the global climate commitments. Secondly, ECT supporters claim that leaving the treaty offers no protection against costly lawsuits. The ECT's sunset clause, which allows investors to sue a country for 20 years after its withdrawal from the treaty, makes a unilateral ECT exit useless, it is claimed. In practice, however, withdrawing from ECT significantly reduces countries' risk of being sued and avoids carbon lock-in from new fossil fuel projects. The ECT sunset clause only applies to investments made before withdrawal, while those made after are no longer protected. At a time when the majority of new energy investment is still in fossil fuels, not renewables, this is important. The sooner countries leave, the fewer new dirty investments will fall under ECT and be locked in by any legal status. Italy took the necessary step of withdrawing from ECT in 2016. Going forward, if multiple countries decide to withdraw together, say the EU bloc, supported by allies such as the UK or Switzerland, they can further weaken the sunset clause. countries that withdraw could adopt an agreement that excludes claims within their group before jointly leaving ECT at the same time. That would make it difficult for investors from those countries to sue others from the group. Recently, a European-wide petition has been launched so that citizens can call on their governments to end ECT madness. Leaving the outdated, climate-killing ECT is a no-brainer. It is not just good governance, but the logical step for all who take global warming seriously. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Short wave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. Again, in continuing with the tradition of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam on the Aql and the Jahl, and the units within the armies of Aql and the units within the armies of Jahl, we have reached, according to the text in front of me, the 37th phrase of this beautiful tradition, where the Imam again mentions two qualities. The quality for the Aql that the Imam mentions is Al-Hub, or love, and that which is in contrast, Waziduhu, that the Imam mentions is Al-Bughz, or hatred, enmity, but a different type of enmity. But this needs to be explained, that hub here is hub for goodness. It is hub and love towards that which is good, that which is pure, that which is meant to be loved. For example, one of those aspects, one of those foundational things that love is meant to be given to is the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. This is a command from the Holy Quran that, you know, their love is compulsory upon everybody. And in bughz also, you know, it is not something that is always bad. But here bughz is for those things that love is meant to be given to. For example, very, you know, hypothetical example, this actually exists, that a person, you know, has bughz for the commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and therefore he is disobedient. For example, the fasting. Again, it's a very, you know, hypothetical example, but it happens. That a person has such hatred for the fasting that it doesn't do anything for him. He completely ignores it and he doesn't do anything. Doesn't even fast. When the holy month of Ramadan comes, it does not show any difference. He actually hates that particular time. Oh, the month of Ramadan has come. You know, I have to kind of hide myself and I don't want people to see me. That I don't want to fast and so on and so forth. This is a very small example. There are many examples that can be given in this regard. However, it must also be understood that this thing is not always good. And this is what it needs to be explained. That sometimes hub itself is part of jahl and bughz itself is part of the aql. How? That you have love for something that you should hate. And you, you know, for example, this dunya. You love this dunya. This is not part of aql. And on the other side, you hate those who hate Islam, or you hate those who hate the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and so on and so forth. Or you not hate them, or you kind of, you know, remove yourself away from them. We have this concept, and we have this in our furu' deen, or the roots, or not the roots, the branches of our faith of tawalla and tabarra. It's clear. And we mentioned this as well in the concept of friendship and enmity. The same kind of discussion can be had there. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to love that which is meant to be loved and to hate that which is meant to be hated. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh, here I am pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The debate.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Netanyahu has been in office for 12 years. His opponents despise him and want him out of office. The longtime premier is also facing corruption charges. Four elections have been held in 2 years, but Netanyahu hoping to garner enough votes to achieve a Knesset majority to lead a stable government, but to no avail. Lapid has mustered a backing of 8 political parties, winning 61 votes in the 120-seat legislature. Are Netanyahu's days in office being numbered?